For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Governor Stitt says he has a solution to counter Medicaid expansion. Stitt told local radio station, Medicaid block grants are the way to go instead. He says the lump sum of federal money would go to providing health care to low-income residents, but the governor's office declined to elaborate on Stitt's comments. Neva, what do you think of the governor's idea?
Well, I think he's tossed something out there. Clearly, this is an idea that some states have taken a look at. Tennessee's seeking to be the first. But the specifics are what I think a lot of legislators and others really want to see. We may still have some time before that happens. It's interesting, though, the political climate for Republicans, even with the Trump administration being very supportive of the concept of the block grants, being able to get something like that through Congress and getting the approval, given the House being controlled by Democrats, with their kind of jaundiced eye on what block grants do and their estimation versus what many conservative members in the House and others believe would be a positive, I think it's going to be this fight back and forth, and where the governor kind of weighs in and how strongly he wants to put a plan forward. We've got, there's several courts now that are already looking at this ACA-related tests. So there's a lot of court challenges that many believe will ensue. And so I think the devil will be in the details.
Ryan.
Well, this, you know, we've been waiting for months now about what the governor's competing plan with Medicaid expansion that's most likely going to be on the November 2020 ballot, what his competing plan was going to be for that. And this really isn't a competing plan because it's not one way of Medicaid expansion versus another way of Medicaid expansion. A block grant is completely different. And in fact, you know, the way the block grant could work is it could actually end up covering fewer people at some point and covering fewer services and leaving people without health care when they desperately need it. That's not really a competing plan for what the folks at the ballot measure are going to roll out. And like Neva said, you know, they're may need to be congressional action. I mean, the administration has said, you know, the Trump administration has said that they're amenable to these block grants that would go to the states rather than the current we pay per user in the Medicaid system, but like a flat rate. That's really contrary to the federal law around Medicaid right now. And so the administration can waive that all day long, but it's going to be subject to lawsuits. And so Oklahomans that are desperate to have some sort of Medicaid expansion, or even folks if they thought that this was Medicaid expansion, the governor's plan would likely take a very long time to implement and roll out. And that's if they could overcome the legal challenge, which I don't think they could. And I think Neva's right. Getting something through Congress on this deal seems impossible right now.
Speaking of getting something through Congress, you also have to get through something through House.
That's right. And I think you know, the issue with block grants, I mean, in the estimation of you know, many folks, and particularly Republicans, have always had this as a by and large a very appealing idea because it gives more flexibility in how you can operate a program, whether we're talking Medicaid programs or other programs that the federal government has used the block grant idea as something to implement. I think states have found that it gives them flexibility. It gives them the ability in their own state to create something that fits for their specific state as opposed to something that's blanket across all states. So the idea of the block grants has extreme merit. It's just now the political, you know, the political minefield that everyone's going to have to figure out how to navigate if, in fact, they can make it become a reality.
And the argument against that flexibility is that the Congressional Budget Office, when they've reviewed the proposal of block grants, because this has been in front of the United States Congress before, it hasn't passed out of the House. And I think even with Republican majorities, they weren't able to get it out of the House. When the Congressional Budget Office looked at this, they said that the flexibility often works against the people in the state, though, the people that rely on Medicaid, because it encourages states to restrict enrollment, limit mandatory and optional benefits, decrease already low reimbursement rates, and then or some combination. And then you end up in a situation, too, where right now the state of Oklahoma gets reimbursed, you know, basically 66% of every person that's enrolled in Medicaid. So that number goes up and down with enrollment. With a block grant, you get a set amount. And so if you have a situation where you have a spike in the need of people that go on Medicaid, the mm-hmm. state could have fewer dollars to actually spend on that. And that could be a natural disaster. That could be any number of things. And so that's the flexibility may sound good, but ultimately it works against the patients.
And I think ultimately the other thing that we have to keep in mind is the legislature legislature is going to have to ultimately deal with this in the coming session, whatever the governor's plan, because it's incumbent upon them to be able to do something if they want to counter the state question that will be on the ballot likely in November 2020.
Criminal justice reform advocates are working to get signatures on a petition to end certain sentence enhancements for nonviolent offenses. If passed by voters, it would keep judges from increasing sentences because of prior convictions. Ryan, what do you think of this petition?
Oh, I think it's outstanding. I think that it's a building block on, you know, what the ACLU and our allies across the political spectrum worked on to get with State Question 780 and State Question 781 and the subsequent measures that have passed the legislature since then, including House Bill 1269 that the governor just signed that allowed, you know, close to 500 people commuted on the largest single day of commutations in nation's history. This is just another road, stepping stone in the path towards a more responsible criminal justice system. You know, Oklahoma has one of the biggest incarceration rates, and people often say, well, what makes us different? And you really begin to drill into the details. You know, we have 70% longer prison sentences for property crimes, 79% longer prison sentences for drug crimes. That's in spite of the reforms that we've done. And a lot of it has to do with these sentence enhancements, because what they do is they give prosecutors this enormous amount of leverage. They can add decades or even life in prison to people that are serving that are being convicted of minor drug and property crimes. I mean, that's an enormous amount of leverage. I think Oklahomans say, if you've paid your debt to society, you're done there. If you get in trouble again, we're going to judge you on the merits of this particular crime. But to add these huge sentences on top of people, that's one of the real reasons that we've got the incarceration crisis that we have in Oklahoma.
Neva.
Well, I think clearly there is this momentum that we've seen as a result of all the things that you just outlined, Ryan. But it will be fascinating to see. We know that many of these types of proposals from the legislative standpoint have had very little traction. I mean, and part of that has been the extreme pushback by the DAs and law enforcement across the state when these proposals and legislation have come up. So again, we'll see in this next legislative session all of these issues that are being pushed as constitutional measures, as votes for the people to decide. It also swings back to the lawmaker side of what do they want to do in terms of public policy and how much they want to engage in this debate. I mean, they've had this is not a new discussion. This is an ongoing discussion, and we'll see whether the Oklahomans for Sentencing Reform, this coalition, can be a more effective driver with the narrative at the legislature, or whether they will see a more concerted effort on the other side to kind of push back. So I think it's this give and take, and I think the public is by and large going to pay a lot of attention to the details on this, because they've demonstrated that they are very interested in seeing these reforms, but they also want to see the results behind the reforms. And I think that's going to be the thing that we'll begin to point to in the next year or two.
And if you look at the polling on just this ballot measure itself, the coalition's putting out numbers that show that 2/3 of Oklahomans, 66% of Oklahomans voters support the concept in this ballot measure. I mean, so it's starting off with an overwhelming amount of support, and that'll probably go down with the negative attacks from DAs and law enforcement that are defenders of the status quo. And that's unfortunate, but that'll come down. But I think that this has a strong chance of passing. And because it has a strong chance of passing, one of the collateral attacks that we're going to see this legislative session, and I think it's going to be led by the State Chamber of Commerce, is an attack on the initiative and ballot, the initiative process itself. I think that the State Chamber and their allies, possibly district attorneys and county sheriffs, are going to try to take that constitutional right away from the people, or to modify it in some way to make it harder for coalitions like this, big bipartisan coalitions, to come together and push reforms that the legislature won't do themselves, and in some ways that the legislature wants. They want this to happen so that they feel like they've got political cover to do more. That's what we saw coming out of State Question 780. But look for an attack on the initiative petition process this legislative session.
And that's what I was going to get to, because it does seem like for years, almost everything that was on the ballot all had to come out of the state capitol. But recently, medical marijuana, expansion of Medicaid, ballot measures, the redistricting. All of a sudden, seems like the people are going, you know what, if the lawmakers aren't going to do it, we are.
And voters love it. I mean, if you talk to people out there signing these petitions, getting involved in these petition campaigns, talk to the people running the Medicaid expansion, the number of volunteers that they had come out of the woodwork saying, I'm not a paid political operative, I've never done this before, but this is a way that I feel like I can be directly involved in the democratic process. I mean, that's across the board, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, everybody, I think, likes this, except for a handful of folks that feel threatened, feel like they can't win the issue whenever it's directly in front of the voters. And that's where I think we're going to see this fight against the initiative
process.
Well,
and I think ultimately, whatever faction we're talking about, ultimately it will be the responsibility of the voters
to make that
decision. And it's their responsibility to decide who they want to represent them in the Oklahoma legislature as well. So, you know, if we can up the game in terms of the involvement of citizens across the state of Oklahoma, that's a gain for all of us.
The state insurance commissioner says he won't enforce a newly enacted law. Glenn Mulready says because of legal challenges, he won't cite violators of the law giving patients the right to choose a pharmacy provider. Neva, this measure was passed by Republicans and eventually signed by Governor Stitt, but it's not been halted by the courts.
No, but you've had the courts overturn in two states, and you have a third that is still under challenge. So, I mean, the trend is certainly in that direction, and I think even the insurance commissioner, the first proposal, the legislation that passed that was vetoed by the governor because he said basically that this is going to wind up in the courts and be struck down. Then they came back with a different version and were able to subsequently pass it, and he signed it. But again, they're kind of back at the same place that they were before, it looks like, for the most part. And when you're talking about specific federal laws, they do supersede Oklahoma law, and you've got these issues with these benefit programs where you are trying to regulate benefit packages in a way that has been struck down as not being constitutional. So there's some real issues here, and I think from the insurance commissioner's perspective, he's being judicious from his office standpoint and not going above and beyond or overreaching and spending money and unnecessarily doing things until there is a clear decision made that is going to stand. So, again, the complexity of this, but the legislature, I mean, kind of being pushed around ultimately by small town pharmacies across Oklahoma, really a relatively small group of people really pushing back on a much broader network of people that were being affected across the board insurance-wise.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that the commissioner's right and not moving forward right now, because this is what, if you begin to enforce that action, and then ultimately, like Neva, you said, I mean, I think that the case law on this seems to suggest it's probably going to be struck down, at least in part, by courts whenever they get to the point of reviewing that. And so, you know, if you begin to enforce that right now, trying to roll that enforcement back, that becomes a really complicated, complex effort in and of itself. And so
open to more litigation.
Yeah, open to more litigation. And so, you know, hitting the pause button right now, you know, paging Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, Medicare for all. I mean, we talk about these pharmacy benefit managers. We talk about the middlemen that exist between insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. And then the largest distributors and chain distributors in the country. And, you know, full disclosure, my wife works for one of those. But I mean, I tell you, you know, when Oklahomans and Americans are struggling with drug prices, I understand the impetus of the legislature. I understand the impetus for small town pharmacies that are trying to compete with the bigger chains and to provide real services in those rural areas in particular. I mean, I get it. But the answer, I think, may not have to come from the state legislature. It's probably going to have to come from Congress.
And it also might deal something that you've got to still make sure that you do something that's legal within our laws and our constitutions.
Yeah. Yeah. Medicare for all.
After multiple delays, Oklahoma.
And I'll tell you how we'll pay for it. That's the.
Are you announcing for a president?
Yeah, really. Well, the deadline. Oh, sure. I think deadline's today, so we'll see.
Just when we thought we all had enough of it. There's more coming.
Just when we thought.
Well, after multiple delays, Oklahoma is finally complying with nearly 15-year-old federal law. State officials plan to start rolling out real IDs by the spring and be in full compliance by October, allowing residents to board a plane or enter a federal building. Ryan, although you originally supported real ID, you have since changed your opinion.
I have changed my mind. It's the shocking. You know, everybody driving their car right now, hold on to the steering wheel. Politician changed their mind. No, I did. I supported this. I thought it was a good deal. But then when you start to look, I don't have the exact figures, but the amount of money that the state of Oklahoma has spent trying to
$21 million.
Think of the way that we could spend $21 million in the state of Oklahoma right now. We're trying to comply with a federal law that does, the only thing that it really accomplishes is that it creates a liability for our privacy. But the actual security that it's going to provide for Americans just really doesn't exist. It's phony. It's kind of a feel-good measure that made us feel better about our security, especially when we're flying in the years following 9/11. But that was just, that was just a fiction. It doesn't really exist. We spent $21 million to get into compliance. And frankly, the state of Oklahoma could have spent $0. We could have never come into compliance with this. And I think that we'd get extensions for the rest of the republic. I mean, they're never going to really enforce this, because cracking down on that and making people comply with Real ID would disrupt so much commercial activity in the United States. You know, the state's going to be in compliance now. I wish that we would have just kept the money in our back pocket and tell them to keep giving us extensions.
Neva.
Well, I think the fact that in mid-December or by mid-December, a very comprehensive marketing plan, they have said, will be rolled out. And it is going to take an education process. Mm-hmm. This is a whole new method of getting a license when you have to have proof of identity, like your birth certificate or passport, it's a social security number. You have two proofs of residency. There's some things there that Joe Oklahoman is going to have to know to be able to go in and get a license. They'll now get a temporary license, and then the actual license will be mailed. I mean, there's some new things in line, and the $42.50 price tag that will be across the board for your license. But the long and the short is what Ryan said. It is here. It's here to stay. It was a long time coming in Oklahoma, but now we have it, and it will be fully rolled out, implemented, and by the end of 2020, I mean, whether it's whatever number of the 650,000 state residents that will need some sort of identification and license, and if they want to be able to go through a TSA check or do something, they are ultimately going to be required to have a real ID to be able to board a plane,
or
go into a federal building,
or a
passport. But you know, the likelihood, if they don't have one, they're not going to have the other. So, these things will be interesting to see from an implementation standpoint, because right now only Oklahoma City and Tulsa areas will be where they will have the facilities, and then they'll have to roll in these other DPS sites across the state, and I think that is into the spring of next year.
I'm a curmudgeon on this deal. I'm going to have the old license, because you can still get the old license. I'm going to use the old license. I'm going to use my passport and protest. it's going to make all the difference in the world.
which adds the question, could there be a political backlash to this?
I think that when people, we're already
seeing...
There'll
be political frustration.
Yeah, I mean, anytime... We've created this huge new bureaucracy that's cost, $21 million, all for paying for a false sense of security. I think that we're so attenuated away from, the idea that this gives us any security. Most people don't even, connect the dots between this and airline safety after 9/11, flying safety after 9/11. It's so attenuated from that, there's not a real political benefit sitting out there. So yeah, $21 million, new bureaucracy. And we're already seeing a lot of political frustration about the closure of driver's testing places, where to get your driver's license. Those things in rural areas in particular, that's already become an actual hardship for people. Well, so.
And there will be kids who are going to be getting a real ID who weren't even born when 9/11 happened.
That's true. And, for the state, I mean, the idea now that they have to maintain, scan, and store all of these documents, there's the added expense ongoing long-term that's going to be required to do that. So there are a lot of, as with anything that comes with the new, there are a lot of underlying strings attached that have to be accommodated.
And good job to Secretary Keating for getting it done. Congratulations on getting it done. I wish you didn't have to. But congratulations on being the person that says that it got done.
Tulsans overwhelmingly supported the renewal of a plan to use city taxes for municipal improvements. More than 85% of voters approved $427 million for streets and transportation projects. Nearly 82% supported $193 million for capital projects, and almost 80% passed the proposition putting $19 million into the city's rainy day fund. Neva, are you surprised by these results?
No, I'm not, and I think the mayor, what he said was really the key point in the improve our Tulsa renewal package, and that was that despite a lot of the consternation in politics and a lot of the differing opinions and sometimes the lack of civility, in this instance, this is another example of a major metropolitan community coming together, focusing on the positives of putting a package together that they could communicate to the voters. This is, and clearly, when you look at it, the voters, the majority of this money is going to street improvements, something that that the voters are willing to spend money on, infrastructure and streets and the things that they care about. And the second part, the biggest part of the package was for things like many of the Gilcrease Museum and the zoo and the cultural, the Greenwood Cultural Center, the animal welfare shelter. Again, projects that the community and the people paying for it want to see upgraded, benefited, their city parks as well. So I don't think it's any surprise. I think it they should be applauded for their effort in bringing everyone together and doing it in such a way that there is just overwhelming support, which is really the key to these kind of proposals.
Ryan, having a super majority on these really gives Tulsa the push to keep doing these and feeling good about it.
Well, and I think it fights back the narrative that everybody's against taxes, that voters are against taxes, because what we've seen in Tulsa, what we've seen with MAPS, and you know, those are initiatives that have been, you know, if you look at the people at the helm of that, Republicans. Mm-hmm. I mean, Republicans and municipal government, you know, Republicans at state government, no taxes, no revenue. Or if you do get it, I mean, it takes you, you know, 5 or 6 years to get there, and you pull a bunch of teeth, and everybody feels real painful over it. But the municipal level, you know, I think that there's a sense by these leaders that, you know, the idea that voters will support taxes if they feel like they're going to be spent in a responsible way, if it's going to be an investment in their community. And so, I mean, I think that that's an important narrative. And another thing that we've got to talk about is the incredibly low voter turnout.
Right.
14% of the registered voters there. So 29,000 votes out of 201,000 folks eligible to vote in the city of Tulsa. I mean, so about, you know, 14% of people chose how to spend nearly $750 million. I don't blame the proponents at all for that. I mean, you know, I applaud them for their campaign and for putting this together and for investing in their community. But we have got to find a better way to conduct these elections, whether that's like putting them on with other elections so that we're not having a special one thing for people to come out, doing vote by mail, have, you know, all sorts of things that we know have worked in other states and other jurisdictions to increase voter turnout. We got to do it here, because 14% of people participating in big decisions like that, that doesn't count.
And that's just 14% of the registered voters. Total population of Tulsa, that's a very small amount.
It is, but we have 50 to 60% of the people deciding, you know, who they want to be president of the United States.
Right.
I mean, we cannot impose that, you know, we're going to beat you over the head enough that you are going to figure out and go vote, even if you don't know what you're voting on. I mean, these people clearly had an opinion, went out and expressed it at the polls for or against. And I think, again, one of the important takeaways from this election is that it was a renewal. I mean, just like MAPS and just like Improve Our Tulsa,
right.
What we see here is when city leaders follow through and do what they say, then the voters have confidence and they will continue to follow responsible projects and programs and initiatives that they put forward. And I think that's the very positive takeaway both for Tulsa and Oklahoma City that they can be very proud of.
Do you think this gives hope for the vote for the officials in Oklahoma City for MAPS 4?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, we're Tulsa and Oklahoma City, I mean, you know, sometimes they're you know, sister cities, and other times they could be countries
on
foreign continents, right? I mean, but I do think that there is that this is a really good snapshot of just voter attitudes towards taxes that they believe invest in their communities, and you know, I think that this probably bodes well for the folks that are running the MAPS campaign.
I would agree, and yeah. I think the December 10th election will again be a referendum on what's been done in the past, mm-hmm. and I think what we're seeing, as we've talked about more than once on the program, is it's the composite view of how to move forward. You know, while you might not like every single piece or every single part of the proposition or the different issues that are being voted upon, you at least know specifically what they are and can make your decision accordingly.
Yeah. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.